This week, our Sunday conversation is with Gabe Petrosio, who anchored our coverage of Inauguration Day from Washington, D.C. He serves as national news editor and authors the weekend newsletter Capital Connection here at FingerLakesOne.com. We talked about the buildup to President Joe Biden's inauguration, as well as the state of journalism and why he launched the Capital Connection newsletter. It's a fun conversation and offers a pretty solid glimpse into the world that journalists were living in throughout most of the Trump administration, not really knowing what that was going to look like.
Yeah, no, it was a little stressful, I will admit. I think it was anxiety-inducing slightly because given seeing the headlines and all the news reports and watching it live unfold on January 6th when, a pro-Trump rioting mob attacked and stormed the U.S. Capitol and in an insurrection, and they're naming it after a coup even in some news organizations, it was very scary to see the end of the Trump presidency unfold in real time here in Washington. So as I was prepping for that moment, I went to a former friend of mine who was a former law enforcement officer, and he actually gave me a bulletproof vest from when he served in the police and gave me some other good advice. And I worked with him closely on security detail stuff in the past when I was abroad and things of that sort. But I was really grateful because you had to be prepared in the event of anything going down. I had a first aid kit on hand. I also had some other gear, knee pads and different outfits and a new backpack and various sorts of equipment. So that way I can carry it all on my own. It probably weighed about close to 50 pounds with the camera, three lenses, the backpack itself, the actual padding and the bulletproof vest and a helmet as well. So, it was a very different environment. And usually as a reporter, you're usually welcome to a lot of places, whether it's open meetings or, public events. But for once, it felt like I was entering a place where you may not be welcome or at least be under threat potentially for that, being a reporter, being a journalist, doing your job. So in that regard, it was really anxiety inducing. But once I arrived to Washington, it was less stressful. And I felt alleviated in part because of the presence of the National Guard and the Capitol Police, which I was really grateful for and thankful for whenever I passed by, especially if there were groups there who were verbally attacking the press. Even in Washington on Wednesday, I was thankful and I extended my gratitude to them for keeping us safe, us and the 25,000 National Guard who were brought in from all across America for this one moment. It was a really unifying effort there to protect a peaceful transfer of power. So it was pretty intense leading up to and then actually covering the inauguration itself on the ground here in Washington.
Obviously, the presence of or the bumped up law enforcement presence, I would assume, played some role in how that day was covered.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I first arrived on the metro, I live just outside of Washington, D.C., over here in Prince George's County, which is it borders technically the District of Columbia. And I take that south, the metro from the area here in Maryland down. It's about a 30-minute metro ride. And as soon as you get off on the stop, I was actually near the convention center, which is about a few blocks over from the National Mall, heading towards Black Lives Matter Plaza. And then if you head in the other direction, it goes towards the Capitol Hill itself, specifically the U.S. Capitol building, as you keep heading down along that stretch to the east. So when I was actually getting off, there was, about 10 National Guard stationed just in that one stop alone on the convention center where I got off. Keep in mind, a lot of the metro stops were actually shut down. A lot of the really prominent ones like Union Square, Judiciary Square, and some other ones that are around the National Mall complex, those were shut down until Thursday. Actually, a day after the inauguration occurred. So that actually disrupted a lot of the traveling and the transportation elements, not just of the coverage, but for people who live in DC and, commute and such. So that really disrupted things. And I also think, we were living in a police state at that point with a military presence that was unequivocally imagined at that point to be down there to see that many officers at one time. There were reports how that the National Guard presence was the single most concentrated part of the military presence across the globe, except for Japan, which is where I believe something like 54,000 U.S. troops are stationed, like military experts and like planners and strategists. It's like the single highest concentration of U.S. military forces stationed outside the United States is in Japan. And that one alone, so basically it matches it. It's about half that total, you know, presence was in Washington when you compare Japan to here. But there were more troops in DC than in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran currently. So that gives you perspective in three of the most, you know, bloody recent wars over the last two decades, you know, in the Middle East. So it was really surreal to be there. It was supposed to be a celebration. Didn't feel like one. It was very somber. And I definitely think the security presence changed how not only the coverage was presented in the news and the mainstream and elsewhere in alternative media, but also impacted the way that people interacted in that space, because there really weren't any protesters. Just like in Albany, there was only one. There were like a handful of people. I think I came across four Trump supporters during my entire time around the Capitol Hill for the several hours that I was there on Wednesday. So that gives you perspective about stomping out, I think, some of the dissidents and some of the concerns around, you know, Trump supporters and mob rioters and other security threats that were potentially going to put the inauguration at risk. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, but I think those elements and that added security presence really changed the way that the story was told, or what story was written for that matter.
When you look at media coverage in general of, say, the last 3 months, and then sort of using Inauguration Day as a pivot point, what do you think maybe needs to change in terms of the way that not just the Capitol, but, you know, Washington, D.C., and frankly, national politics should be covered? Or what elements do you think need to start to evolve there?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, it varies, I think, depending on your readership and where you're located and what we're seeing. I think to summarize the last several months, I mean, leading to the eventual, you know, disavowing of President Donald Trump is, I think, unprecedented, given the second impeachment trial is currently being considered. And after the House of Representatives voted to impeach President Trump for a second time, we had the actual insurrection on January 6th. And what really is an unprecedented inauguration day, I think history will look back. And I think those images specifically of the really strong, heavy military presence on the ground here in Washington will not be easily forgotten. And I think that will be a part of the lasting legacy that was incurred here by Biden, who became the 46th president of the United States on Wednesday. And I think moving forward, there has been a lot of initiatives, I think, from the Biden administration to really push forward in unifying the country, not just through the media and the way that we're telling stories, but on a political, I think, in a cultural fashion as well, about bringing back ideals of generosity and respect and decency and dignity in Oval Office specifically. And I think we're going to see more of those olive branches extended to those who felt disinterested by this president and who didn't vote for Biden moving forward. I think when we bring back some of that coverage that focuses on less of the divisiveness that was being reflected by the president at that time, President Trump, I think that's going to help change how we interact in our own communities here in the Finger Lakes and elsewhere, you know, and how we interact with each other, even if we have difference in views. And I think that's going to help potentially heal that divide and move forward with further coverage that impacts, you know, national politics here in New York, or, you know, national politics that impact other communities and specific groups of people. So I think that is like the first step in many ways, especially after all the executive actions that he signed just on his first day in office, which is unprecedented too in its own way. You've never seen such a reversal on so many issues, things that we reported on, like going back to the U.S. Census when they wanted to actually not mark undocumented immigrants in the census, which was a mandate by Trump in July of this summer after we spoke with Jeff Beller, who runs the U.S. Census. So simple things like that were reversed yesterday, 2 days ago now at this time. So I think that step in reversing some of those decisions is going to help bring it back. And then I think peace and bringing decency, dignity, integrity, and respect back to the Oval Office and the White House will help with greater coverage elsewhere.
When it's been very interesting, especially in the day before and through the day after Election Day, catching some of the bits off of cable news, seeing the number of polls that are still being relied on as major drivers of talk, of news, of discussion. Mm-hmm. Is it time, do you think, that we start to dial back in general, not just now, but during election season, all the time, start to dial back how heavily or how frequently heavily relied on or how frequently used polls are in coverage of anything in general when it comes to these big, sweeping, often divisive issues?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, anyone who reads a poll or a report of that sort should really closely and keenly look at the fine details. I don't care if it's, produced by the Washington Post, ABC News, Marist, Politico, Fox, you pick the outlet. I think you have to look at the specific parameters, even Gallup polls in that respect, which are really popular among media. At that point, I think it's worth mentioning that I think we should lessen our reliance upon pollsters in some ways, because we are seeing that there is inefficiency in how they're reported as quote unquote fact of that day. And that's what a poll really is. It shows you how someone thinks of something at that particular time when that occurs. They're not really good at tracking long periods of time. They're good at condensing singular moments or instances of issues and factors about people and things of that sort and political topics. We saw that even here in upstate New York, specifically with our congressional races in the fall with Representative, John Katko fighting what would have seemed to be his most challenging race to date, where he was actually down in the polls in the Siena College poll by 2 points, but somehow won by record-breaking numbers, the most that he's ever won since joining Congress in 2014, and the highest disparity between candidate from Democrat to Republican in that district for the last decade. And that was just shortly after him being one of the most revered bipartisan members of Congress. And he was facing a tough race, what seemed to be in the polls, but that didn't actually materialize in the end game. And little do we know, a few months later, we see Representative Katko being the first Republican to say he'd impeach President Trump. So it's a really interesting time. And I think if we relied more on those polls, the outcome could have changed potentially. And so it's very interesting to see how polls shape the way we understand things. But I do believe firmly that we shouldn't prioritize them as much as we have in recent years, especially given the outcome recently with polls in the last 4 years since 2016 on. It's been really on a decline, I think.
Yeah. And when you look at sort of the state of journalism, and obviously there always tends to be a lot of coverage of numbers and poll figures and things like that, especially during election season. But then when we get outside of election season, it's almost like the polls are used as sort of a grab bag for journalists who are searching for something to really strongly cover. But there are so many important, nuanced policy issues that can be explored and looked at. And it seems now more than, say 3 months ago, there's an appetite for things that aren't just coronavirus related or aren't just election related. How do you feel as a journalist looking forward, knowing that there's in a lot of ways, a lot of new ground that can be explored and be, uncovered now that we are officially fully past this past election cycle?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think now, we're looking at the pandemic, and I think the pandemic really encapsulates, I guess, the American experience right now, given because we're currently fighting it. That isn't to say that there aren't stories that are right separate from or not directly related to the pandemic. But I think everything touches now the pandemic in that respect, which allows for greater opportunity for us to really dive into some of the facts and information around maybe some of these underreported issues and how they're impacted by the coronavirus specifically. How are they impacting our communities, our districts, and our country at large? So I think there's a lot of potential. There's still a lot of wiggle room, I think, and elbow room for journalists to go out there and find niche beats and to specifically explore unique issues as we currently have been for the last year and then some, with covering the basics of the coronavirus pandemic, but also the impacts of it on the election and policy specifically around the coronavirus. I think once we're out of the pandemic, I think that trend will continue. I think because how poorly the United States has been handling the pandemic, with 400 plus thousand people losing their lives, Americans losing their lives to the virus since March. We're coming in almost, you know, we're like basically 9 months, 9, 10 months out in from the next year, from March or so, when this really started. To think that you almost lost 500,000 people, you know, obviously we didn't have a good handle on it because it was that extreme. So I think once the pandemic is quelled, then I think that there will be more room for reporters to go out and explore a lot of that uncharted area. And I think there's a whole aftermath story too. And that's not to say the pandemic's going to be over instantaneously by the first year or, you know, maybe first few years, but there's definitely going to be a series of aftermath stories and how we come back to our, you know, society and how we come back to our country and how do we become a stronger trader and supporter of our allies abroad. And there's going to be a lot of coverage, I think, on that to come in the national discourse, but then also how it impacts us locally, regionally here in the Finger Lakes and upstate New York and elsewhere for that matter. So I think there is a lot of potential despite the cold winter and dark nights at this point.
A lot of discussion, obviously, before, after election, through the current day about the integrity of journalism. Fake news is the word that we've heard thrown around most over the last 4 years. What would you like to see as a journalist, whether it be change in the industry or maybe journalists do differently to try to start to make inroads with those who do not have confidence in the work that journalists are doing, even though it be right, even though it be full of integrity and oftentimes not laden with the criticisms that it frequently be thrown at?
Yeah, for full disclosure, I do firmly believe that journalism is under attack. I think if you work under that underlying premise, the answer can come, or answers or direction to how you can respond or react to that reality becomes clear. I think it's clear when I've been in speaking from personal experience, specifically covering the MAGA Million March back in Washington, just a week or so after the AP called the race for President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris at that time. When the election was called, there were several thousands of people who came from all across the country to here, to Washington. And there were people in the press, you know, colleagues and such, who were attacked, who were pushed away from covering that event. In some ways, there's, you know, this, as you said, this disavowal of information, of fact and truth and things of that sort with good reporting, with good quality reporting. And there were people who were, you know, injured through those efforts. And the Metro and the Capitol Police had to intervene during those instances. But I did meet one person who I spoke with, and he was from Texas. And we talked for a while, and he says that, you know, I don't like that MSM, but I do like you. And he's like, I don't believe in all that stuff, but I do like you. And I think, I guess in some ways, you have to start small, and you have to, you know, you may not obviously agree with everyone, and that's not your job as a journalist, but, you know, start small, I think, is the answer, is to start interacting with people that you wouldn't normally, or, you know, embrace those type of people in your coverage, and you're diversifying your stories, depending on where you're from, you know, and what regions you're covering. So I think that takes a step. And I think you have to overcome those adversities and some of those structural challenges like safety, right? As I said before, with people being pressured to not cover the MAG A Million March. At that point, there were some people who said, you know, why aren't they covering us? But then they're pushing the press away. So it's kind of like a give and take there. It's a double-edged sword. You can, but you can't. And I think that partly has to change some of that animosity, because I think once you're having people put their guard down a bit, I think then journalists can do their work better. If you're able to enter those, you know, those circles and be able to, right, engage at that level, I think that helps. And then you bring the fact and the truth in there, which it shows that there was no evidence that shows that the election was in fact tampered with or engineered to favor the Biden-Harris ticket versus Trump and Pence. And I think once you come to that conclusion, it becomes clear about how journalists and reporters on the ground, not just here in New York, but elsewhere in D.C., here in the Capitol, but all across the country, can react and move forward in this age of upheaval for misinformation and disinformation and social media blockouts and shutdowns and all this that's occurring simultaneously. So I think that's a strong in the right direction to start off for such a big question.
Yeah. And I think the point you brought up about individual conversations seems to be the best method, because it's like, you know, how many times have you and I sat and looked at the comments on Facebook on any given story? And, you know, you try to dive in there and you try to, you know, help some people understand why something was covered the way it was covered, or you try and sort of explain to them why what they're viewing or what they're showing is incorrect, or it's false, or whatever the case may be. And it's like, because of the herd mentality of that environment, there's very, very little chance of making inroads. But if you have a conversation with that person, with a person in private, it seems, at least in my own experience, like what you described with that individual from Texas, it can work out sometimes. And more times than not, I would say they either open their mind to something that they wouldn't be open to hearing in another environment, or at the very least, they're willing to have a conversation, which is also something that seems like it's not, you know, not always possible in that big sort of arena feeling, arena-like scenario that is social media. When you think about journalists and mental health, I want to ask you about this, because I think given the intensity of the things that journalists are left covering, do you think it's time that there be a little more energy and a little more widespread focus on sort of, I don't want to call it like frequent check-ins with reporters or journalists who are on the ground covering these incredibly difficult moments in history, but, you know, that mental health at least be more part of the conversation within newsrooms, at least to the end of helping and enhancing the experience of these journalists who have an incredibly difficult job?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that's a really crucial point. I think for a long time we were in the profession speaking, not really great at doing those checkups and getting our editors to look at our groundbeat reporters, our broadcasters, our correspondents who were out, you know, covering your brutal accidents, your car accidents, your homicides, you know, not just that gory or bloody mess of news, but some of this more, right, very political, socially costing coverage around, right, very divisive issues and you know, social unrest all throughout the summer and, you know, violence and actual fatal deaths in the case of the insurrection, you know, going back to January 6th. And I think newsrooms are getting better at it. At the national level, there's a lot of discussion with a lot of the leading journalism training institutes, specifically Poynter, who I work closely with Al Tompkins, who's an excellent source. And he works very closely with embracing mental health awareness with his wife. And they work very closely on doing trainings like that for newsrooms and for editors to help, you know, teach them lessons about how to like manage their own mental health and stress, but also how to check in on their own workers and employees and, you know, freelancers, contractors, you name it. You know, I think we're fortunate here at Finger Lakes One, where we have a very closely knit community among our staff, where we're always interacting with each other in a way where we're always checking up on each other and helping each other and trying to mitigate that stress. You know, and I'm grateful for that, but not everyone has that. And especially for the people who are freelancers, I think that's really difficult. There was a guy that I met recently. He's a freelancer and at a conference, a national conference I was at, and he has a lot of mental health stress issues, and he was very open about it. And I admired him talking during the session on mental health about what he feels, because freelancers by their definition are basically alone in many ways, because they don't have a direct newsroom that they work to or interact with. So for him, it's really difficult. And so he uses social media to, you know, explain himself and his own situation to the world, which is, you know, very bold, but admirable. And long story short, I think the profession's making strides in that direction to do that. But I think it's a comfortability thing too. If your editor isn't really close to you or doesn't really work with you on a more personal or intimate level, who's not really familiar with your own personal life or like things that you care about, it can be difficult. You know, there's a barrier or a bridge to cross in that respect that would, you know, limit any possibility of that type of conversation to come out to say, hey, are you okay? Like, is it all right? And for journalists, you know, the news cycle never ends. And we know that here at Finger Lakes One or at 24-hour news, you know, anything can happen anytime. And so, you know, duty calls and you got to go, you know, and it's hard to kind of step back and say, no, you know, slow down, you know, take a break. It's difficult. You know, I speak from personal experience on that. It's not easy, but I think when you acknowledge it, it gets better.
Yeah. And to your point about, you know, not all newsrooms being, you know, as personal as the one you and I come from, you know, I've been in that kind of newsroom before where it's very, I'll call it corporate. It's very dry. It's very impersonal. You know, I think that, and in particular for freelancers, those are like the two big focus areas that I think about when I think about mental health and journalism. Fortunately, I think a lot of the community news organizations that have sort of popped up and cropped up over the last 6 months to a year and even longer than that, some of the nonprofits, I think they probably are a little better at taking those things into account and being more cognizant, at least, of the mental health challenges or struggles that a lot of journalists probably face. But yeah, there's a lot of work to do there. Another thing I wanted to talk with you about, obviously newsletters, we've been cranking them out. And in particular, your Capital Connection, which launched a couple weeks ago now. Give us sort of the lowdown for somebody who's listening right now, who maybe hasn't heard or hasn't read the newsletter before. Give us a little sort of overview of what you're aiming to accomplish in that every Saturday morning.
Yeah, I guess in the elevator pitch, you know, it's essentially keeping you a click away from the nation's capital. You know, that's the motto here at Capital Connection. And every Saturday, we're going to have some of the most interesting stories and most insightful reads from the national media. So across all different platforms, regardless of political affiliation or leaning, and as well as our own coverage from the ground here in Washington, here with me running Finger Lakes National News Desk here, our Finger Lakes region for all of our readers out there. And basically, you know, giving you the weekly headlines here from Washington, the national news cycle, especially these last 4 years, has been really endless in many ways. And oftentimes we miss some really important issues that are not necessarily always percolating to the top. And so I think for us, it's a mission to essentially go after condensing some of those overarching weekly themes that we're seeing not only here in Washington, but across the country, you know, in different policy issues and aims and initiatives and legislative efforts and political movements and issues and, you know, topics around, you know, elected officials, specifically some of our own New York elected officials, whom we'll be tracking every week. You know, our senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, as well as our local congressional leaders and Representative John Katko and Representative Tom Reed of our districts in our coverage area. So every week we'll be keeping the most current up-to-date news headlines around them and their efforts and what they're doing for us in Congress here in our congressional cornerstone. And there's also some statewide titles in the headlines that are really important things that were coming up to the top in the statewide news coverage that are worthwhile to read. So really, you're getting local, state, and federal news all condensed into one place. So you don't have to do all that searching for yourself. And it comes every Saturday in your inbox. So I highly recommend signing up. We're growing our audience every day. And I recommend it to you and to get all the great other newsletters like Sunday Insight and our weekly, daily morning editions.
Yeah. And I really have to credit you with having your eye on newsletters as an angle of pursuit, because I want to say it was shortly after you graduated from HWS that you and I had a first real conversation about launching the Sunday Insight. And, you know, within, it seemed like just a few weeks, we got that up and running, and obviously that's evolved quite a bit. And now I'm quarterbacking that while you're taking on the Capital Connection. And it's interesting because there's such an appetite for it. And it's odd, at least for me, and you can interject your thoughts here after if you'd like. It's strange to me because it seems like people can get news everywhere, and they're getting blasted by it everywhere, right? No matter what social network you're on, you're getting hit with news. If you're online, you're getting news from every like search engine and like place you could possibly go to on the internet. And even sometimes the ads that you're seeing on the internet are news related ads. So it's just like, it's everywhere all the time. You turn on the TV, it's there 24 hours a day. You listen to the radio, it's often the same thing. And yet what we're finding in our own experience, and I don't want to get in too much into the minutiae about our own data, but it's as if there's even more appetite for news via newsletter. And, you know, as someone who's, you know, working in the news every day, 24 hours a day, it's kind of astounding to me, or at least that's the way it feels. I don't know if you kind of feel that way too, but it feels astounding that there's even more people who are also interested in getting a newsletter every morning or getting a newsletter every weekend. It's remarkable, honestly.
I think there's a simple explanation to it. I guess I was always shocked at how well they perform in our engagement and our interactions with every newsletter that we produce, not just the weekend editions, but listen, I I have sensory overload and I work in the business. You have so many things happening at once. There's so many news stories happening. There's so many publications. I think there's saturation. And I think with saturation comes curation. And with that curation, specifically of creating newsletters that focus around, right, topical themes, digestible analysis, and coverage from a wide cloth of publications. Sometimes they're publications that none of our readers have maybe engaged with. If they're local DC publications, they would have never known about had they not read the newsletter. And that's partly because of geography and where they live and what they rely on. But for here, you know, people are listening and reading to DCist and WAMU and a bunch of other papers like City Rag and Politico's, you know, magazine in the morning, The Hill. You know, and we're opening their eyes to a lot of those new publications to them, new to them specifically. And I think because there's so much content out there and it's so hard to track it because we all have our own daily lives, and that's what journalists are, is to track things for other people because they can't in some ways, because they don't have the time to, you know, go out and do that reporting for themselves, you know, because that's what we're here for, to build that trust. I think it becomes very clear why there's such a growing need in many ways for newsletters. And especially in our region, because of the way that it condenses, right? It condenses, essentially, the Capital Connection condenses a week's worth of national news in one day, in one, right, newsletter. So it's all there. Yet, you know, obviously not every story is there. Not every major, quote unquote, breaking issue is there, but all the major marks are there. And then there's always related stories that are embedded in all those stories. And then you can click on those and then you can go find out even more. And then it's just the web, you know, it's the internet. But I think that's the value proposition to readers, is that you get it all condensed without the noise, without ads, and and that's just how it works, you know, on that end. I think that's why we're seeing such high engagement And, you know, such a really rapidly increasing subscribing rate for us and retention too.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. And as always, I appreciate you you taking the time, and I appreciate your hard work over the last several months, and obviously much longer than that since you've been with us. Gabe, appreciate you taking it today and talking with us and talking us through everything that's been going on down in DC.
Thanks, Josh. Take care. Talk later.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. If you're still here, there's two things I'd like you to do that can really help the show. First, share this episode with your friends and family and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts if you're there. Second, sign up for our daily newsletters. Throughout the week, we've got you covered, and each of those newsletters is aimed at keeping you informed and up to date on the week's news in a short amount of time. Monday through Friday, your morning edition from the FL1 news team. Then on Saturdays, The Capital Connection by Gabe Petrazio, and Sunday Insight on Sunday by me, Josh Dursa. There's a link in the show notes to sign up today. As always, thanks for listening, and we will catch you next week.